welcome to Spectator Out Loud. I'm Fraser Nelson. Each week, we ask a few of our brilliant writers to read their piece for the magazine aloud. On this episode, we've got Matthew Lynn reading his cover story about the vaccine wars and how the rollout has become the first geopolitical battle of the century. Then we've got Anthony Seldon and why we need a museum for Britain's Prime Minister, a role which is 300 years old this Tuesday. I hope you're going to be celebrating. And then finally, Sam Leith, our literary editor, about his own personal love of Doc Martin boots, the perfect footwear, he says, for every occasion. First, Matthew Lynn.
Armed guards are patrolling the perimeter fence of a sleek factory. Software experts are fending off hackers. Border officials are checking trucks and ferries, not for weapons or illegal immigrants, but for a mysterious biochemical soup, while spies and spin doctors are feeding social media with scare stories, flaming one national champion or another. Welcome to the first great geopolitical battle of the 21st century. It may sound like something ripped from the pages of a dystopian sci-fi novel, but in truth, we're already seeing the opening salvos in the vaccine wars. Rather than cooperating with one another to roll out a global vaccination campaign to rid the world of COVID-19, the major powers of the world are instead descending into a fierce, increasingly nationalistic competition. The EU is threatening to hold back supplies from Britain, the Americans are scooping up supplies wherever they can, and the Russians and the Chinese are engaged in a form of vile diplomacy, reminiscent of the Cold War. It is starting to turn very, very nasty. We are seeing how quickly our globalised world collapses when push comes to shove. The effect of all this on national security, on industrial policy, and on the movement of people around the world will be felt for many years to come. Rewind just a few weeks and it all looked very different. First Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech, then Moderna, and then Oxford AstraZeneca unveiled one success after another. When the COVID pandemic began a year ago, lots of experts warned that it might take 10 years or more to develop an effective, safe vaccine. Nor was it ever going to be easy. Keep in mind that some of the biggest drugs companies in the world, Francis Sanofi, for example, and Merck of the US, Pfizer's great rival, failed at the first or second hurdle. To get not one but three vaccines in under 1 year was a miracle. As those results were revealed, it was easy to imagine that a solution to the crisis was close at hand. Except for one thing. The politics got in the way. It turns out that deploying vaccines is harder than it looks. A quick glance at the league tables makes that clear. Israel has jabbed a remarkable 45% of the population, by far the highest rate in the world. The United Arab Emirates has managed 26%, partly with China's Sinopharm shot. The UK has managed a very credible 10.5%, and the United States 6.9%. But the rest of Europe has been lamentable. Only 2.1% of Germans have been inoculated, and less than 1.6% of people in France, which lags behind Slovakia. At the current rate of rollout, it will be 2024 before most of Europe hits the 70% inoculation level believed to be necessary to take a population to a critical level of immunity. Australia and Japan have not even started yet, while much of the developing world has been left to fend for itself. At this rate, of the major economies, only the United States and Britain will vaccinate themselves out of lockdown this year, and both countries may have to introduce strict travel restrictions to avoid importing new strains from abroad. Britain, spooked by the battle to find plastic gloves and other PPE in the first wave, wrote into its contract with Oxford AstraZeneca a stipulation that vaccines made in Britain would be offered to Britain first. We signed in May. The EU dithered for an extra 3 months and didn't agree terms until the end of August. It failed to extract similar promises of delivery. It will now wish that it had. The blame game has already started. The EU hijacked the vaccination programme, wildly overpromised, and then failed to deliver. It ordered too few vaccines, made some bets that went wrong, including the failed Sanofi vaccine, and didn't put down enough money up front to allow companies to prepare for mass production. Like any cornered bureaucracy, and in a manner eerily reminiscent of a failed state, Brussels has started lashing out, blaming everybody else. At the start of the week, the Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte and the EU Council President Charles Michel threatened the drugs companies with legal action to ensure supplies. The saga took a darker twist when, on Tuesday, the EU said it would need to be notified before the export of any vaccines from the EU. Its commitment to internationalism seemed to have gone completely out of the window. There appears to be an underlying belief that somehow the perfidious Brits were siphoning off Pfizer and Oxford supplies that instead should have been reserved for Europe. And yet, oddly, the Oxford shot has not even been approved in the EU. A requirement to print the label in multiple languages is reportedly one of the many hold-ups. AstraZeneca was in the surreal position of being threatened with legal action by a series of European governments for not delivering a vaccine that is not even legal to sell within the EU. And in Italy, with Italy's La Repubblica, AstraZeneca's chief executive, Pascal Soria, argued that because the EU had signed contracts much later than the UK, there hadn't been nearly so much time to sort out supply issues at its plants on the continent. With the UK, we have had an extra 3 months to fix all the glitches, he said. In other words, it was the failure of the Commission to move more quickly that caused the problems, not the company. Even more weirdly, briefings began appearing in the press, starting with Handelsblatt, the German equivalent of the Financial Times, that the Oxford vaccine might not work for the critical over 65 age group, with only 8% efficiency. It later turned out that the German media had got itself into a muddle over the data. Only 8% of the people tested in the trials were between 56 and 69, but that is not the same thing as saying it is only 8% effective for older age groups. It looks suspiciously like one of the Facebook-friendly conspiracy theories Putin's Russia might cook up. The dismal reality is that we will have to get used to those kinds of reports, even though they risk undermining faith in all vaccines. If truth is the first casualty of war, as the old saying has it, then one way of knowing you're in a war is when truth goes out of the window. And by that measure, this one has already started. There is more to this story than just the squabbles between the UK and the rest of Europe. In the background, Russia and China are using vaccines as a form of leverage. There are plenty of takers for Sputnik and Sinopharm, especially since the better-tested Oxford and Pfizer shots will be in short supply for months to come. Deals are being signed around the world, and with each one there will no doubt be strings attached. In time, President Joe Biden and his advisers will have to work out how to get vaccines out across the developing world, or else surrender influence to America's rivals for a generation or more. Given that the two most widely used vaccines were invented in Britain and Germany, Europe should by now be leading distribution, instead of squabbling over deployment. In this race, it is worth noting, the West is already losing badly. Europe has turned on itself when it should be working out how to counter the inoculation imperialism of its two greatest rivals. There will be a high price to be paid for that. In truth, the vaccine is turning into the weapon of choice in a new version of the Great Game, an intense rivalry between competing powers, played on multiple different levels, between many different players, and with different weapons. True, the immediate problem will fix itself to some extent. By the end of the year, we may well have a vaccine glut, with billions of doses available. There are more on the way. The Johnson & Johnson single-shot candidate is expected to report test results shortly, and production is being ramped up around the world. Making vaccines is tricky, but not that tricky. With enough money thrown at the challenge, production will get up to the 4 or 5 billion doses a year that may be needed to keep COVID at bay. But the fierce rivalries of the past few weeks will still have long-term consequences. Countries will inevitably start working on plans for vaccine security. What will that involve? At the very least, their own research facilities, their own testing networks, probably involving challenge trials where volunteers are deliberately infected to see if an inoculation works, and massive state-of-the-art manufacturing plants ready to crank out millions of doses in the blink of an eye. The UK is already a long way down that track with its new Vaccines Manufacturing and Innovation Centre in Oxfordshire, designed both to perfect and manufacture new shots. But we should expect most other developed countries to match that, and probably to spend even more. In a world of vaccine wars, development and supply hubs will be as closely guarded as nuclear silos once were. Misinformation campaigns will ripple across the internet about one formula or another, and spies will hack their way into rival national labs. At the same time, borders will close, as is starting to happen within Europe and across the Atlantic, as governments battle to keep countries free of new variants. Futurologists spent a lot of time speculating what would be the geopolitical fault lines of the 21st century. Now, it seems, we have our answer.
That was Matthew Lynn. Next, Anthony Seldon.
Thursday, 3rd of April, 1721, was an unremarkable day in political London. No fanfare nor ceremony surrounded King George I's appointment of Robert Walpole as Britain's first Lord of the Treasury, i.e. Prime Minister. Merely a paragraph buried in the press. We are informed that a commission is preparing appointing Mr. Walpole First Lord. Yet here was the start of what has become the longest lasting head of government job in the democratic world, and its anniversary, after 300 years, falls on the 3rd of April this very year. Expect, though, no fanfare nor drone pyrotechnics in political London to mark the occasion. Our political leaders will, inevitably, be attending to the pandemic and other pressing concerns. But that does not mean that we should let the moment pass. Many countries make much of the history of their heads of government and state, including the United States, which has museums and research centres for every president, but not in Britain. Visitors cannot enter Number 10, nor even Downing Street. The merest of glimpses of the building through heavy iron gates blocking off what used to be a public thoroughfare is the most they can see. This is expected in an autocracy, but in our democracy? Is it surprising that the young are cynical and switched off from politics when the job at its apex feels so remote? Robert Walpole served 21 years, still the longest tenure, and he cemented the office within the British Constitution. Between him and Boris Johnson, so alike in temperament and circumstance, there have served 53 prime ministers, some magnificent, others lost at sea. They took decisions that shaped the modern world. For 55 years, the 13 colonies that became the United States of America were governed by them. The histories of China, India, and Africa have been critically affected by what the Prime Minister of the day decided. Foreign policy, traditionally the domain of the monarch, had passed to the PM during the tenure of William Pitt the Younger from 1783 to 1806, who directed the wars against France. For the rest of the 19th century, Britain was the dominant global power. And even in the 20th century, decisions taken by prime ministers rippled powerfully across the globe. Where can visitors go to understand more about the prime minister? The answer is nowhere. Prime ministers' decisions equally shaped the United Kingdom, including the abolition of slavery, the extension of the franchise, the rise and fall of the British Empire, the welfare state, policies in Scotland, Wales and Ireland. Where can students go to understand more about this? The answer is still the same. Downing Street is inseparable from the Prime Minister, as is the White House from the US President. All since John Adams in 1800 have lived in the White House, but the current building was completed only in 1829 after the British burnt down its predecessor in 1814. Several of Robert Walpole's successors were too grand to live in Number 10, but since 1877, when Benjamin Disraeli moved in, it has been the Prime Minister's home. Every room in Number 10 is a time capsule of history. The front hall, where tearful staff clap out departing prime ministers and nervously clap in their successors 1 hour later. The cabinet room, where debates took place that precipitated the Declaration of Independence by the United States in 1776 and the decisions to go to war against Germany in 1914 and 1939, to give power to the trade unions and to take it away, to enter and to leave the European Union. The Prime Minister's study, where so many of those decisions were pre-cooked. The stateroom upstairs, where H.H. Asquith was told about the death of his beloved son, Raymond, on the Somme, where Baldwin thought through the abdication crisis, and where Benito Mussolini, the only dictator to visit in the interwar period, strutted and puffed. The Prime Minister's flat at the top of the house, where William Gladstone, Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher took defining decisions in their premierships. Every single room is bursting with stories, dying to be told. Every piece of furniture has its own history. One might expect any nation on earth to be brimming with pride, desperate to let everybody know about these priceless assets. Not us, at least not yet. Now, might Brexit be the time to reconnect with our national history? It divided the country, but can we now unite to understand the past better, the good and the bad, and to celebrate the best that has been achieved by the human spirit, courage and imagination? The coincidence of the 300th anniversary falling at this moment of national reckoning prompts hope that a museum of British premiership might be set up in London, with digital access and outposts spread across the country. We have similar hopes for the National Archives Trust, which tells our collective story with documents. Key rooms in Downing Street could be displayed in the museum with materials from prime ministers, great and small. From the first prime minister's car to Thatcher's handbag, and interactive exhibits showing the waxing and the waning of prime ministerial power. An understanding and respect for the past makes for better decisions and for better people. Nowhere is the historical deficit more keenly felt than in Downing Street itself, where staff, ironically, rushed and focused on the immediate, do not appreciate the glories of the building in which they're working. They might serve the nation better, and we might be a better country for a museum of British premiership.
That was Anthony Seldon, whose book on the subject is out soon, and finally, our Doc Martin-loving literary editor, Sam Leaf.
Doc Martens are one of those quintessentially British things that, like the royal family and lorries queuing on the M20, turn out actually to be Germany's doing. The ancestor of what became the Airwear Soul was designed in 1945 by a German army doctor with a sore foot. Amid the post-war hurly-burly, he salvaged a cobbler's last from a shop in Munich and knocked himself up an air-cushioned shoe to relieve his discomfort. Pleased with the success of his invention, he and a pal went into business producing bouncing soles. The delicate question of what Dr. Merton did in the war, and whether he salvaged his shoemaking kit in the same way Hermann Göring salvaged Rembrandt's, is not easily resolved by a Google search, but no doubt, had he been a raving Nazi, we'd have heard about it by now. Just be on the safe side, though, his name was anglicised when in 1959 the Northamptonshire bootmakers Griggs bought a licence to produce those bouncing soles in the UK. They slapped a stout leather upper and some fetching yellow stitching on the product, and on April Fool's Day 1960, the Bother Boot was born. It's very pleasing to read that half a century later, the company has reported pre-tax profits of more than £100 million and is eyeing an IPO no less greedily than any Silicon Roundabout unicorn. Good on them. The DM is for everyone, At various times, it has been the signature footwear of pop stars, skinheads, hippie girls in floral skirts, and my one-time colleague, the city editor of the Daily Telegraph. I've worn almost nothing on my feet but Doc Martens since I was 16, which is now a bit more than 30 years ago, and every few years my feet come back into fashion. DMs are not cheap. A good stout pair of standard 8-hole boots will set you back north of £100. But, as they boast on the instep, the soles are highly unlikely to dissolve if you step in a puddle of acid, or oil, fat, petrol or alkali. They will last you a good 2 or 3 years at least, which cannot be said of your fancy trainers, even if you avoid puddles of acid. And there's no feeling quite like the triennial busting out of the new boots. You really do bounce when you walk, and you feel about half an inch taller before the soles start to wear down. What's more, they are suitable for all occasions. If you keep them well nourished with something called dubbin, they will keep your feet dry on even the muddiest of country yomps. I've worn my DMs to the Arctic Circle and the bottom of the Irish Sea, and I can attest from experience that they do not mark tennis or squash courts. A friend once posted me some flip-flops after she saw a photograph of me wearing DMs with swimming trunks on a beach in Sri Lanka. I was touched, but she needn't have. They were very comfy. They also go perfectly well with formal wear. I was never chucked out of the reform club for wearing DMs, though my now wife was chucked out for wearing jeans. When I was a judge of the Booker Prize, I was presented to Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cornwall in black tie and DMs. The yellow stitching gives them, I fancy, a slightly dandyish effect. So let me venture on this authority, my first and only stock market tip. If they do go public, fill your boots.
That was Sam Leaf, and that's it from Spectator Out Loud this week. Thank you very much for listening, and do pick up an issue of the magazine if you want to read these articles and the many others we've got. It's full to overflowing of the best writing you will read anywhere. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Max Jeffrey, our producer.